Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Mathematics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Corey Brunson, a host of the channel, and I'm talking today with Snejana Lawrence, author of A New Year's Present from a Mathematician, published by CRC Press this year, 2020. This is a collection of 12 historical vignettes that span Europe across five centuries of mathematical exchange, plus a jump back one millennium, which we'll get to. Rather than recap only the most recognizable names, Dr. Lawrence also spotlights a range of types of mathematicians, by their stations in life, and by how they engage with their mathematical communities. Indeed, the diverse and sometimes improbable channels through which mathematical knowledge is transmitted are essential to these stories as the practitioners who do the transmitting and receiving. The book is a delightful mix of historiography, mathematics, and often poetic narration, not to mention glossy-paged and, appropriately, gift-sized. And I'm glad to be able to talk with the author as we approach the new year. Snejana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Corey. Delighted to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. To begin, could you describe your own mathematical background and how you became inspired to write this book?
Okay, so my first degree was actually in architecture and engineering. And when I came to England, I wanted to do a little bit teaching of geometry, which I was incredibly good at. And I was sort of thinking of how I can employ geometry that I learned and I did at the university back in old Yugoslavia. And to my surprise, I discovered that geometry is actually taught quite differently in different countries. And that was the start of my historical journey through mathematics. So I realized that although, you know, mathematics is a universal language, it does not necessarily have all the poems and books in each culture. And so I started really doing then the history of mathematics became my focus, and I started doing PhD here in England. So I call myself a historian of mathematics rather than a mathematician. Through my book, you will see also that I have a bit of a take on that as well, you know, how people perceive themselves, the types of mathematics they do, and how they sort of, how very few people call themselves mathematicians.
Yeah, I'd actually like to get into that a bit. In the context of whom your book is intended for and what readership you had in mind, you do explicitly tie this question of who identifies as a mathematician into your introduction. And it resonated with me personally in that it was several years after completing my PhD that I started dropping the qualifier aspiring from the way I would describe myself as a mathematician. So could you talk a bit more about your intended audience and that notion of perception of oneself as a mathematician?
Yes. So I think there are lots of preconceptions about what mathematicians are like and what do they do and what mathematics is as a field, as a discipline. And so people do find it, I found through the experience that people find it very difficult to identify themselves as mathematicians. So I think I give an example where at a conference where there was about, I don't know, more than 50 people in a room. And when I asked who here is a mathematician, it was a mathematical conference I might had. Only three people said, you know, put their hands up. And I was like, well, what are the rest of you doing? You know, this is a mathematics conference. And likewise, I think from the outside, from a view of mathematics and mathematicians, from people who are not actually involved in mathematics, they sort of have these visions of mathematics, basically mainly to be dealing with number. You know, if you can count or calculate quickly, you know, that is mathematics, and that is what mathematician is like, and nerdy person and so on. And over the years, I felt that really is, it can be very funny to engage with those images, and it can be sort of quite, you know, nice and funny to sort of think about them. But actually, it does mathematics quite a lot of damage, particularly in terms of education. So my book is intended for the audience who is, for people who want to learn a little bit more about mathematics. So there are some mathematical sort of terms there and concepts. And I think I was pleased that one of the reviewers of the book said, you know, that he is a mathematician. He sort of found it very good that he found things there that he didn't know about. So that is important to me as well. But it is also intended for the audience, for the person who wants to know a little bit more about what mathematicians are like as people, just as normal people. So I sort of trace that journey.
And so let's get into the journey. Your tour, as you call it, departs from the Library of Alexandria. So could you say a bit about its significance to the histories you're telling and its role in the metaphorical journey of the book?
Yes. So it starts with the Library of Alexandria because there is quite actually a lot of looking back towards ancient Greece or ancient Greek culture and Greek mathematics throughout the book. So it's scattered throughout, you know, the sort of concepts and mention of people go throughout the book. So I thought it really needs to sort of start from there. But it also starts from there because symbolically, when we start learning mathematics, you know, people usually sort of think about that, you know, everything starts with Greece and then it goes on in the historical development. And also, it's about the dissemination of knowledge and about the influences cultures have on each other and how important ancient Greek mathematics has been for the development of mathematics. So there is a thread there also in the concepts that I discuss throughout the book.
And actually, it's not long before you delve into some of the ancient Greek mathematics and how it was transmitted further forward in time. We have time to discuss a few of your vignettes, and I'd like to begin in February.
Okay.
This month, you celebrate the completion of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople in 532. The cathedral was designed by Anthemius of Tralles and Isidore of Miletus, and you explore how both of these architect mathematicians built upon work that was already ancient by their time. So could we talk through them both in turn?
Yes. So Anthemius of Tralles was really quite an important mathematician of his time. And he also studied, we can't be actually 100% sure for quite a lot of the things that we are from ancient mathematics. But so we can't be 100% sure that he produced this sort of collection of Archimedean works. But he obviously was very knowledgeable in the ancient Greek mathematics. And we need to sort of just go a little bit. I need to mention that, for example, Anthemius of Tralles lived and built, worked on that cathedral, Hagia Sophia, in the 6th century AD. And the mathematics he drew upon Some of it came from the 5th century BC. So it's quite a long, you know, range of mathematics that he was obviously aware of. So he built on the knowledge and the works of Archimedes. So one of his treatises that has been rediscovered in the 18th century treats the question of the burning mirrors. Okay, and so that's one of the most famous questions from antiquity. Did Archimedes really build these burning mirrors? You know, in theory they should work, but had he really built them, and did they actually work? And that question reappears, and you know, even popular television programs, you know, have been in the past couple of decades. And so Antimius wrote this treatise on the burning mirrors, and he was a bit of a trickster, so he knew quite a lot of applied mathematics. So I sort of opened that chapter with a trick he played on his neighbor, but I won't explain the, you know, people will need to read it.
Sure, we can leave it.
Okay, so he was a bit of a trickster, and he was interested in, obviously, applied mathematics, particularly for this purpose of building this fantastic dome of Hagia Sophia. His collaborator, Isidore of Miletus, comes from a very famous place, which is Miletus in Turkey, but it used to be, you know, part of the Greek kind of culture. And he worked with Anthemius on. He also knew quite a lot of ancient mathematics, because where he comes from, we have some of the most famous sort of mathematicians and philosophers from ancient Greece. Again, there is a huge range between them and Isidore, but he was obviously aware of the work that he built upon.
Yeah, so there's a lot that comes out of this vignette or this chapter that I appreciated. The distances through which mathematical collaboration and heritage are transmitted, even in the absence of a continuity there. So you mentioned that Isidore was almost certainly aware of the heritage of his location in the ancient history of mathematics, and drew upon that. I don't remember how you put it, I'm sorry, but drew upon that that heritage in his aspirations, in his work, as well as, of course, upon the works that he directly, the mathematical works that he directly drew from.
That's right. Yes. So Miletus was a very famous. It's a famous philosophical school, really, from ancient Greece, and there are people like Thales of Miletus, which is arguably one of the first really mathematicians from ancient Greece that is still really studied, I suppose, for his contribution to mathematics. Apparently, his advice was "Know thyself," which was engraved on the front facade of the Temple of Apollo in Delphi, and he was one of the Thales was one of the seven sages of ancient Greece, which is another, you know, it's not really a myth; it's a story about the seven wisest men. So I suppose we are in the period of the three wise men, but these are seven very wise men from the period before Christ, you know, around the 5th and 6th century BC.
I'm sorry, you have to remind me. Thales has several theorems attributed to him, which might be called Thales' theorem. Was one of these instrumental in the design of Hagia Sophia?
Yes, so that's right. So Thales was very important for really having these theorems which were transmitted through ancient Greek mathematics, and there were quite a lot of work actually from Greek mathematics went into designing that famous dome of Hagia Sophia. So, for example, Anthemius is also known as the first person to describe a method of drawing an ellipse. And he sort of uses, in his treatise that I mentioned, he uses a Thales theorem, which is now, you can actually place it within Euclid's 13 books. And it's a book 2, theorem 6. So I'm not going to read it to you because otherwise it's, you know.
Right.
But yes, it was an important knowledge. They also used Archimedes' circle approximations, or really the approximations of pi, for the construction of the dome.
Yes.
Yeah.
So capping a circular roof on a rectangular or square-shaped foundation.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So they had to. Yes. Exactly. So it's almost like squaring a circle. But so
right. And
they had to be quite precise executing that mathematical kind of concept.
Yeah, and I think it's also always worth remembering that even someone like Euclid pooled together the results that many results that were already known in his time, as opposed to writing whole cloth a geometry textbook that became the definition of geometry for centuries following.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So exactly. So the collection of Euclid's elements is a collection of all mathematics known at the time, really. You know, he wasn't necessarily the author. It was just an organization of mathematical knowledge in a certain way.
So, jumping ahead, from May, the month of May, which is your fifth chapter, I should have mentioned earlier, the chapters are arranged by month, mm-hmm. You celebrate the birth of Maria Agnesi?
Yes, that's right, Agnesi, yep.
In 1718. So to put Agnesi's life and work in some societal context, I think you do very well by discussing this popular math book by Francesco Algarotti.
Yes.
So I hope you would provide a bit of that context here.
Yes. So Agnesi is an interesting person for me because she's such an independent and obviously incredibly talented mathematician. And she was actually the first woman to hold the chair in mathematics, although I believe she never actually took it up, you know, she never actually went and taught people. But she grew up in Milan, and her father sort of really used his children. She had another sister who were very knowledgeable in all, in languages, in mathematics, in music, and their father organized salons around their sort of performances, you know, so they would recite and they would talk in different languages and so on. So from a very early age, she spoke many languages, she knew many languages, and she studied then modern mathematics. She wrote a very famous book, which was Italian translation of Newton's Principia, which is still used, really. But what is interesting is that her mathematics was really very obviously, authentic. But also, she knew her stuff. Whereas Algarotti comes as one of the beau esprits of his time. He was a sort of very well connected, from a very sort of, in England we would say posh background.
I think posh resonates in the US too.
Yeah, that's right. And he traveled around Europe, made friends with aristocracy and very famous people. Frederick the Great gave him a title. And he even became a Prussian count. And he published a popular book, Newtonianism for Ladies. And what was interesting for me was that book became incredibly popular. and it was translated into English. I mean, it actually was written in Italian, and it was translated into English, and it became very, very, very popular. Whereas Maria Agnesi's work, which was really original translation and could be used for the study of mathematics, didn't really have such a great success at the time. You know, it did survive all the other later kind of uses and additions. So it tells a story a little bit about popular and what is acceptable, what people perceive as a sort of popular kind of mathematics. And so he had a great success during his lifetime. But it is also slightly annoying for me, which I think you probably find when you read it, that he sort of adopts this patronizing voice towards women. And that I found it very funny. Because there was Agnesi, who really did proper mathematics, and there is this amateur who's sort of taking, you know, who's patronizing people who study, or women particularly, who study mathematics. He's trying to make mathematics, or physics rather, easier so that women can understand it.
Yeah, even as you recognize his good intentions, I think that story also resonates with some of our experiences in the present day with respect to whose mathematical work gets accepted for having, for its own original quality, and whose gets accepted for its commentary on the rest of the community's mathematical work.
Yes, that's right, too.
So I'd like to dig a little bit more into Agnesi herself. You mentioned her multilinguism at a young age and her focus on mathematics education. She was also an advocate for education and incorporated some of these ideas into her book, and is also known for having written a treatise in her youth about, I believe, access of women's education.
That's right, yes. So she was a great advocate throughout her life, really, of women's rights. You know, when we look at it now, it probably doesn't appear so kind of revolutionary. But if you think about the time when women weren't accepted really to even go to universities, let alone to teach, you know, for her to be able to write, translate mathematics, and to get a first chair in mathematics. And she was very much dedicated to the sort of causes of women. Later on in her life, she really gave up mathematics altogether and became a full-time theologian and worked in worked as a director of the Hospice for Women, which was a hospice for women who were really quite unfortunate in Milan. So I think, you know, there is a whole other dimension to her life, which is not necessarily obvious. So I wanted really to give her a little bit of to illuminate that kind of side of her life, because that was, I think, very important.
And yeah, if I may say, the book is very good at humanizing its characters well beyond, in many cases, their mathematical contributions.
Oh, good, thank you. Yes, I think, so, and also, what I found really quite funny is that so this is one of the very lone women in mathematical landscape of the times. She translates Newton very, very well and adds some original contributions and some contributions from Italian mathematicians. So she mentions this, she talks about this curve, which she called La Versiera, but which later on was translated into English as the Witch of Agnesi. And that itself also sort of tells you a little bit about the perception of women mathematicians, I thought, that anyone would actually have that as a, you know, thought, that someone would call that the curve witch.
That's a good point. So how likely is it that someone's curve would be mistranslated as a witch if they weren't a woman mathematician?
Yes, that's right, exactly.
So jumping ahead to July, you mark the birth of John Dee in 1527, and your hook in this chapter, that he was the inspiration for Shakespeare's character Prospero, was new to me. So could you briefly profile Dee, his personality, his interests, and, of course, his betrayal?
Yes. So Dee is incredibly interesting for me. I also didn't know that he was most likely used as a model for Shakespearean play The Tempest. I found that out when I was doing a project with teachers, and we had to do something. This was about 2 decades ago, I think now. The teachers had to connect various subjects that they were going to teach. So they had to connect English, and in England, you know, Shakespeare is studied quite studiously still. And so they had to somehow connect Shakespeare with science and mathematics. And I really, you know, I was a bit stuck, I'm afraid. So I came upon Tempest because I thought that would be very good for science as well. But then I realized, came across several references that actually Dee was used as a model for his Prospero. Yes, Dee is a fascinating personality, really. His view of mathematics is absolutely enchanting, I think. His preface to the first English first edition of Euclid's Elements in English language is a very famous, really, now preface. You know, you can buy a preface itself without without the rest of the book. And he sort of saw mathematics as such a diverse field. I recommend everyone actually to have a look at to sort of look on the internet and find what he called ground plat, which is a schema of his view of mathematics as a field, where he structures various disciplines, various sub-disciplines of mathematics, and quite a lot of them are applied, which is another sort of thing that I'm really interested in. And his betrayal, it's quite strange because he seemed to have had premonition, but nevertheless went into it. he had a very good friend. Dee was, by the way, he was quite a mystic. He used to draw charts and sort of tried to predict sort of astrologically things that will happen. But he, you know, that is only one really facet of him. And that also has a mathematical kind of meaning that I'll come to at the end. But yes, he seemed to have had a premonition of his books being burnt and wrote about it in one of his diaries, which I found fascinating. And he went with a friend of his, Edward Kelly, to Europe with they took their wives as well with them. And Edward Kelly, I'm afraid, persuaded him that they should swap the wives. And I think that really broke him. And he came back from Europe. By the time he came back from Europe, he found that his library has been ransacked. Quite a lot of the things from his collection were lost. And they were lost for, you know, quite a long time. A couple of years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years now, there was exhibition of his items from his collection and his books in London, which was fantastic. But you know, they're still you know, that whole library was really dissipated. So his friends and students just went in the house and held themselves, it seems.
So you mentioned that Dee was a mystic, and also that he was fascinated by the order and role of different mathematical disciplines with respect to each other. This is something else I've found fascinating in the past and done a little bit of scientometric work on the on the literature of mathematics. As you say, Dee understood mathematics as a bridge between the so-called natural and supernatural phenomena, as he would say at the time. And this comes out in his classification scheme, as you detail in the book. And so I'm interested if you could expand on this division as Dee understood it, and whether you see a through line to our present day classification schemes, in particular, perhaps the way we think of pure as opposed to applied mathematics.
Yes. I think that such a division still remains quite a lot. I think people doing applied mathematics are considered sort of slightly different by the people doing pure mathematics still. You know, you can see that in social sort of mathematical structures as well. I don't know globally how valid that is, but I know in UK there is a reasonable distinction between, you know, pure and applied mathematicians. But actually, to me, it really, you know, is fascinating, because I obviously, that is another thing that sort of I can see perhaps as an outsider, because my view wasn't like that at all. But what I particularly like about Dee is his description of mathematics, as you say, as a medium between studying these supernatural phenomena. So that is how he describes supernatural phenomena, as something which is hidden, where you have to understand the patterns, you know, of the hidden sort of forces and things. Whereas the natural, and so that he says, you know, so that sort of apply, that is the field of supernatural sort of studies, of which he obviously was quite fond. And then there are natural things, material, compounded, divisible, corruptible, and changeable. So that is the study of nature. And then in between those, he places mathematics, and he places mathematics within its all branch, with its all branches that he sort of mentions. I found there was a book a couple of years ago on sale, which had some kind of his notes against the frontispiece, where he started drawing the description of the division of mathematics. So originally it was much smaller, you know, than the final sort of grand plot had many more branches there.
So an early version of his introduction, where he presents this classification.
That's right.
And so following up, one of the most prolific mathematical writers was, and this will be a challenge for me, Jean-Baptiste Le Rond d'Alembert.
Yes.
Whom you remember on the anniversary of his death in October 1783. Like Dee, two centuries prior, d'Alembert was a central player in the organization of mathematical knowledge of his time. So could you talk first about his contributions to the encyclopedia, and perhaps what the encyclopedia was at that time?
Yes, so I found actually inspiration to write about him and to look at his life a little bit more, because although he knew later on who his parents were, he was left on the steps of a church in Paris when he was born. And the famous novel by Victor Hugo, Notre Dame de Paris, which was written in 1830s, describes that sort of event in a way. So he became very knowledgeable and in quite a lot of subjects, and contributed to Encyclopédie, which was the first really encyclopédie in the world, which contained contributions from different people. There were other similar projects, but they were written usually by one person before that. So this is the first one where different people contributed only in the areas of knowledge that they felt they had, you know, that they were good at, rather than sort of pretending that they know everything. So he wrote with Diderot, who was one of the Denis Diderot, who was the co-editor with D'Alembert. Sorry. And they wrote something like 72,000 articles for the encyclopedia, which is quite amazing, isn't it? I mean, it appears that D'Alembert wrote about 5,000 pages of mathematics for this book. And to me, that sort of seemed like a huge number. And even if he wasn't, he's not necessarily actually considered a great mathematician, because his contributions were not, you know, hugely important. But the amount of mathematics that he wrote and was knowledgeable in, to me, was quite considerable and definitely deserved mention. But also, I was interested in him only not only because of that, but also because of his life and because of his view of the fourth dimension. So that was the first view that I have found a French or any sort of modern European or American mathematician mention. So he in one of his articles, he describes a fourth dimension as a possibility. And I thought that is quite important, actually, that he, you know, he's the first to sort of tackle it. Like, it's like, well, let's consider it.
Now, was this in the context of physical time, or was this in the context of mathematical abstraction?
It was in the context of physical time. So yes, a time span to be described as a fourth dimension
alongside the three dimensions of space.
Of space, that's right. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So actually, I wanted to segue into this higher dimensional geometry topic that D'Alembert was working in, because it was in a similar way, I think, to D'Alembert, who was not known nowadays as a great mathematician and who grew up from what I assume must have been considered humble beginnings. The area he was working in was, at the time, relatively open to professional and amateur mathematicians alike. So it seems appropriate that he would be playing a lead role in the writing of the encyclopedia, and it seems appropriate to include him as a role in your book. And I was interested if you could speak specifically to his study of character, where he tried to outline principles governing good character in a similar way to the organized principles of science.
Yes, I found that quite fascinating, actually. So one of the things when you look at D'Alembert, and if you try to find things about him, one of the things that comes as striking is his portraits of D'Alembert. I mean, he appears to be really quite a happy and lucky kind of person. You know, quite a lot of the images of mathematicians are, you have a sort of a frowny kind of character looking at you from the other side, but D'Alembert is always smiley and sort of happy, and he looked at tried to study the principles of life, and one of the things he found within this kind of more philosophical work was that he said that the only safe kind of harbor for a person is to keep changing. So he understood that change, which to me was incredibly modern. And he also described what happiness is, that can only be found if a person is able to see the world just as it is, to learn how it works, and to always maintain the balance between his own interests and also fulfilling the duty to humanity. And those, to me, are really very sort of true principles I really liked. I wanted to sort of mention that, because usually we sort of try to romanticize to sort of make things easier for us. But he said, you know, no, so to see it as it is, learn how it works, and do your duty. And I think that is quite a lesson, actually, from mathematics.
And so, actually, to follow up on that, and you don't put it in quite these terms in the book, but Johannes Kepler comes across to me as an exemplar of D'Alembert's principle of balance, as you just articulated it. And you can tell me if you think that's fair. For one, he famously accepted that his nested polyhedral model of the cosmos did not hold up to the evidence that planets traced elliptical orbits, which came through at his time, and which you discuss in the book. But in this final chapter, on December, you showcase more of his creativity than I had been familiar with. So I'd also be interested if you could say a bit about his proto-science fiction story, The Dream.
The Dream, yeah. So that is fantastic, fantastic story. I really, when I came across it, I couldn't believe it, you know. And as most people, I think if you come across it, you think, you may think, gosh, this is, you know, was he mystic? I mean, he was a very religious person as well. But his mother was accused of witchcraft in 1617. And a very unlikely result of those trials, Kepler stood in her defense, and actually they managed to, you know, managed to free her, which I understand wasn't the usual sort of result of the witch trials. So in his book, The Dream, The Somnium, he describes this young person who goes around the universe, flies around the universe with his mother. And it's sort of, you know, it is called The Dream, so it happens in a dream, but actually it's pretty realistically described. And they go on this adventure to see how the solar system works. And his mother is really, you know, portrayed as really a little bit quite witchy, I suppose. So I thought, gosh, when I came across this, I thought, wow, you know, who knows? But then I read a little bit more about it, and I saw that actually he started writing something, a record of, he was considering what would the solar system work look like if you could stand on the moon. So what would the planet Earth look like, and the solar system, what would it look like by someone who can stand on the moon rather than as we are standing on the Earth? So he was really starting up from a completely different premise to write this story. But then the witchcraft trials took place, and my hunch is that he had a lot of fun describing this and adding this sort of supernatural element to his story. Because there were people who believed that his mother is a witch, and sort of it's a take on that as well as the actual little bit of a science fiction. Well, some call it the first science fiction novel in the West. And I think he took a particular pleasure in sort of bringing the two together. There's one line I'll read to you from that novel. While my mother lived, she would not let me write. She warned of evil men who reviled the hidden arts because their dull minds could not grasp them, who spread lies and made laws that harmed the human race. And I found that quite sort of telling, really, that how he married this experience that he had with his mother, that he had to defend her and this little novel. The novel wasn't actually published during his lifetime, so he never published it. So it was published later after he died, posthumously.
No, it seems wholly consistent with the tradition of science fiction to have to, for it to be very rich in societal commentary.
That's right. Yes, exactly.
So your book's title and its cover are both inspired by Kepler's treatise on snowflakes.
That's right.
This is a wonderful story, and so I'd like you to talk a bit about how Kepler was inspired to write this treatise and what work it has inspired since.
Yes, so Kepler was living in he was living in Prague at the time, and he made good friends with I think it was a prince in Prague, Weckenfels. Kepler himself was born on the 27th of December. So I imagine that he had received a present from this patron of his, and that he was thinking how to return the favor. By all accounts, he was actually a very good friend and sort of person. And obviously, I think his, you know, his morals and sort of that you can sort of see through his, for example, that little book Dream, come across quite clearly. So, going home from seeing his friend, he was thinking of what to write for his friend, and he knew that his friend didn't really want anything, and he mentions that at the beginning of this little treatise. So I would imagine the conversation went between them something like, well, what shall I give you? And the this person's this his friend said, nothing, you know, I love nothing, you know. That is one explanation. The other explanation could be that he actually said, I like space, you know, I don't like anything. You know, I just like emptiness, to think about space. And so Kepler was going home. It was a very snowy night, which in Prague is quite often around that time of year. And he looked at the snowflakes and he thought, why are all the snowflakes of a particularly similar shape? So he wrote a treatise on that, which is absolutely beautiful, and which set out quite a lot of sort of things, the mathematical concepts that only recently have been confirmed in sort of in the 20th century, really.
So here you're talking about, one of these is very famous, the sphere packing or circle packing, the circle packing theorem, I guess, and the sphere packing conjecture for a long time.
That's right, and the honeycomb conjecture.
Right. Could you distinguish those two? Because I was new to that distinction, actually.
Okay. So the honeycomb conjecture relates to the sphere packing, but it's not exactly the same. So it is about the honeycombs. It really treats it. It goes from it looks at the hexagonal structure of the honeycomb and sort of discusses. What is the best way to divide a surface into regions of equal area with the least total perimeter? So that's a bit of a, just the take is different. Mathematics is almost the same, but you're sort of looking at different aspects of that.
So wrapping up our discussion of the book, your chapters are as much histories of ideas and their transmission as they are histories of people. And it strikes me that each one can be read as a case study in how scholars synthesize ideas and communicate ideas. Was this a conscious part of how you selected these scenes for inclusion?
Yes, I'm not actually sure how it happened, to be honest. I wanted to take people on a journey. And when I started thinking about that journey, I sort of structured it in different layers, I think. So it turned out that actually quite a lot of people have different, they're doing different mathematics, but they all sort of have something similar, I think. They're sort of my type of people for one reason or another. So I looked at them as being friends on this journey. So I learned more about them. And that is really what I want to do. I want to take people on this journey so that they can learn about these people as people, whilst also seeing what mattered to them most. Because that is one of the, I suppose, the biggest questions, you know, why do people do mathematics? They don't do it, you know, for any particular reason other than it is so important you have to do it. And I think that is what I really wanted to show.
And so, while I didn't touch upon them in most of my questions, but throughout the book, in addition to geometric figures to describe some of the theorems or ideas that these individuals are dealing with, you include photographs of memorials, other landmarks, reproductions of key documents, reproductions of artwork. And I wanted to be sure to ask you about the importance of artifacts to our understanding of mathematics and its history.
Yes. So it came naturally, really, because it is part of that landscape. It is part, I wanted to really make it almost like a film, you know, a sort of imaginary film for people to open a door, a crack, and sort of look at the scene, you know, and for each month there is a little scene painted for them about mathematics, about the people, and about the artifacts. And I think our artifacts are incredibly important for to get that and to feel immersed in that landscape. You can't really do it without them. And art as well has been a long-term interest of mine, where you can see through art how, I suppose, concept, not only concept, but how understanding of space and people changes. And it does actually link up a lot to the mathematics of the time depicted.
Mm, that's right. And that does come out in multiple of your chapters, including that on D'Alembert, with the advent of four-dimensional geometry and books like Flatland.
That's right.
That were very artistic in their presentations.
That's right, yes. Yeah, Flatland is one of my favorite novels, actually.
So, to now wind down, what is another piece of scholarship or media that you think makes a good companion to yours?
What do you mean, to this book? Or...
Yes. So say I'm getting this book as a New Year's present to a mathematician. What would be a good accompanying book or film or website or other piece?
There are lots of films of mathematics. Well, they're not necessarily films of mathematics. I don't actually particularly like the films about mathematicians because they're usually inaccurate. But
I feel the same way often.
Yeah. But I do like films, you know, science fiction films. I do particularly like Interstellar, actually. That is one of my favorite movies. There is a lot there that is perhaps sort of somehow similar to this, you know, The Somnium by Kepler.
That is a great point, actually.
Yeah.
I remember being thrilled by the music, the sound quality, and the visuals in that film, even as I had some reservations about the way the science was communicated and told, but it was absolutely a stunning piece of art.
Yes. And I sort of liked it because it did have something very surprising to me that I didn't expect, which I think every great theorem actually contains, you know, so that's why I like it. You know, it sort of has a little bit of, you know, mathematics in all kinds of different guises.
It's true.
Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely one of my favorite films.
Very cool. And so now, to ask the traditional closing question of New Books Network, what are you working on now?
So I'm working on a book. I'm not going to give you a title, though.
That's okay.
But it's going to be slightly different. It's not going to take necessarily... It will have a lot of historical data as well, but it will be more about people... And it's going to be aimed at people who want to really look at mathematics in a slightly different way. So that it will be based around different objects, but those objects are not necessarily going to be, you know, physical objects. They might be constructs.
Mathematical concepts.
Yes, concepts and sort of constructs. So I will ask people to sort of look at that, at such an object, you know, from different angles. So I suppose a little bit like meditation on some objects. I'm not yet sure how many chapters are going to be, but it's not going to be based about the calendar year.
Okay. I will watch out for it. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
So I've been talking with Snejana Lawrence about her book, A New Year's Present from a Mathematician, published this year by CRC Press. Snejana, thank you so much for joining me on New Books in Mathematics.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Corey. All the very best, and have a very good New Year.
To you too.